Good evening, everybody. Thank you for joining us on Talking to the Expert. My name is Gil Moore. I am the director of the CES Mod Center, and my area of research interest is reproductive immunology. I will ask each of the members of the panel to introduce yourselves, and then we will initiate the conversation on reproduction infertility, both male and female.
I'm Steve Prowitz. I'm a professor. I'm in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology in fetal therapy, and also in Center for Molecular Medicine and Genetics.
I'm Dan Rapley. I'm a principal investigator and professor here at the Mott Center. Our lab studies stress effects on early mammalian development with interest in the causality of miscarriage.
This is Kim Farrell. I'm the professor of traditional medicine and bioinformatics in the University of Michigan. So I'm data science of medicine. So I analyze the data from biology.
I'm a professor of physiology department and OBGYN department. So my major interest is to study mammalian spermatogenesis and also male-based conception.
Thank you.
I'm Joshua Bimenek. I'm an associate professor at the Mott Center and OBGYN department. I study oocyte cell biology and cell division.
My name is Richard Pilsner. I'm a professor at the Mott Center as well as OBGYN, and I focus on preconception, environmental health, and sperm fitness.
I'm Doug Rutten. I'm a professor in the OBGYN department. I'm in charge of the female fertility group at the Mott Center.
Thank you.
I'm Kyle Orwig. I'm a professor in the OBGYN department at the University of Pittsburgh, and I study stem cells and their application for treating infertility.
Hi, everyone. My name is Ruhi Jalani, and I'm a fertility doctor, and I'm lucky enough to work here at Wayne State and also at Kind Body.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And again, I really appreciate that you are joining us. At the end of the day, it was a long day where we have a very interesting scientific discussions in the title of this seminar here at the Mott Center, Navigating Fertility, Science, Solutions, and Future Directions. And I think a lot of the conversation that we're going to have this evening is related to those topics. This is, again, I would like to invite the public, whenever you are, if you have any question, please feel free to put it in the chat. We will read your questions, and one of the experts will answer your questions. Again, we are giving a little time to people to join. I think it's admitting, but we will start the conversation as they start joining. So, infertility, both male and female, is a major challenge. We heard this morning about the success of reproduction. Maybe we start with you, Dr. Jalani. Tell us a little, how good are we in reproduction in general? We reproduce very easy or we have problems?
Short answer is we're not really good at it at all. It's a miracle that we actually do exist.
Really?
The egg development, embryo development, implantation, miscarriage. And when you sit here and I counsel my patients and I tell them, every month that you try, the chance of conception is the greatest when your peak fertility, which is age 23, is 25 to 30%, right? That's at 23, which, to be honest, no one's really trying to conceive at 23. So now scale it back to when we're actually trying to conceive, or late 20s, early 30s, it's 10 to 15% for cycle.
10 to 15%. That's very low.
Yeah.
And really, it is a miracle that we are here.
Yeah.
Try hard.
We're trying hard. Yeah. But let me understand a little of this aspect, because, and then we put it in the table. We always think that, and we read the books. I love history, so I read the books in the Middle Ages and even some today. Infertility, we always say, we focus on the woman, on the uterus of the woman, the ovaries of the woman. And gentlemen, do you have something to say about the other side of the game?
Not too much.
I think it's important, it's important to, go off Ruby's answer is, The World Health Organization thinks that you have normal semen parameters if more than 4% of your sperm look normal. So imagine
I'm not just saying
4%.
4%.
So you're normal if 96% of your sperm is.
Okay, so we are joining again. We had a little glitch with the Zoom, but I hope we will continue without any problem. So in reality, we see that there is a lot of factors, the male, the female, and I hope we will discover additional aspects. Why don't we start answering some of the questions in the public? Tell us what you have, for example, the first one. When trying to overcome fertility and seeking treatment, is there emotional, mental support the toll of, that it takes on couples?
That's a great question. I can start.
Why don't you start?
Yeah, I 100% do think it takes a toll on couples, and it's super important to navigate this journey for the long term, right? Like, we think, and I always tell couples, like, you think you're sitting here and seeing a fertility doctor is very reactive, that you're here because you've tried and we failed and we're here. So intervention, i.e. insert doctor, is going to solve the problem. But like we said, we're not really good at reproduction. Like, we can control all our variables. We can get the egg. We can create an embryo. We can test it to make sure it's euploid. We can have this beautiful uterus, and it can still not work. We're not close to 100%. At the peak, with all our variables controlled, we're at 60 to 70% positive pregnancy with a 40 to 50% take-home baby.
Wow.
So, and that's usually from the onset of when you actually seek a fertility doctor to when you actually get pregnant is a 4 to 6 month timeline. So I think it's super important to look at all aspects and intervene with mental health support.
We talk sometimes that the stress of trying to get pregnant is the best contraceptive, especially to the woman. What about the male? Does stress affect the male reproduction?
And I think that's right up your alley.
Well, I think more on the female side. I can say something to actually sort of back up what Ruhi, Dr. Jalani was saying. What we know is now that IVF is in existence is if you culture a mouse embryo and add adrenaline, it grows more slowly. If you culture and add cortisol, it grows more slowly.
Wait, cortisol, what do you mean? What is cortisol?
These are the fast stress response. If a woman's having problems with social environment, hard. So adrenaline is a fast and cortisol is a more chronic stress.
Okay.
And so that's one part of the story. Growing slowly is not good for an embryo, for its possibility of success. The other kind of balance hormone is a satiety hormone called leptin, which is
over my capacity
but
knowledge.
I tell you why this is important. Satiety means it means you're well fed. If you're well fed and you're a woman, it means you're ready for pregnancy.
Okay.
So if you add leptin to IVF culture embryos, what do you think they do?
So what you mean is we need to feed properly that embryo.
I think
and maybe
that
we can
psychological stress of facing infertility, facing treatment, is very important.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Part of the
so the, when we talk about infertility, we have problems producing oocytes. Is the egg of the female producing this the sperm that is the germ cell of the male? What other problems with infertility do we have, Dr. Julian?
So many.
So let's put the most relevant at the beginning of the play.
Yeah. I always say let's break it into ovaries, tubes, uterus, sperm.
And then we will go to the male.
Yeah. We get this beautiful embryo. Then we're dealing with this whole unknown world, reproductive immunology, inflammation, autoimmune cells, implantation defects, receptivity. Because I think there's so many variables that are so hard to control.
So we can say a little that we can divide that. One would be the failure of the embryo to implant. That could be one of the early problems.
Yeah.
And the second, miscarriage. There is a question about miscarriage. Do male factors contribute to miscarriage? Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Somebody could answer that question. Dr. Kowitz.
Sure. The answer is most likely. There are certain factors that father will deliver at fertilization. And those factors influence the early stages of pregnancy. Challenge that we face is that when we don't face it alone, we face it as a couple.
Mm.
The couple that is trying to conceive, it is the couple that is going to have the child.
Yes.
We have to actually turn our thinking around to look at it with, as the couple. If we do that, we can then tailor certain protocols together and help the couple through the journey, because it is because it is something that they have to do together.
Very interesting. Are we treating the patients as a couple? You think now this?
I think we're starting to. I think there's more and more data to support sperm testing, analyzing the sperm. The problem is we have all of this testing, but we don't have a solution just yet. Hopefully that's what we're going to work on.
And maybe we will talk with you some exciting things that you mentioned, that it looks like we are in the 22nd century. I'm very excited that you share with everybody what you have. But let's see what other questions we have. If semen, we have a lot for the males. If semen parameters are poor predictors of pregnancy outcomes, what do you think are better predictors? Rick?
I guess that's part of my talk, right? We're still working on that, but I think we have to harness all the new technology that we have out there, the sequencing and the omic data, so the genetic
sequencing
data.
Omics, oh my goodness.
Yes, I know.
Now you lost me. Now you completely lost me. What is the meaning of omics? What are you talking about?
We have to look under the hood, right? Semen parameters analyze things, the shape of the sperm, how many sperm you have. But we have to get inside the sperm to look at the molecular signal.
All the machinery of the sperm.
Machinery and harness some of those markers on those sperms that are
linked. Explain to us a little, what is the meaning of omics? I think it's a word that is all the time. And again, maybe Dr. Ruda, he's the expert in all this. Dr. Ruda, could you explain us a little, what is the meaning of omics? We read it in the newspaper, we hear it in the news. And I don't know if everybody understands that.
Yeah, omics is sort of a made-up word. They stick on the end of everything. So if you study pizzas, you're called a pizza omics. You study hot dogs, you're hot dog omics. So genomics is studying the genome. RNA omics would be studying RNA. So
it's
massive scale.
It's the massive scale of the
stats.
The massive scale of the stats. Perfect. Thank you. How do male lifestyle factors, diet, exercise impact pregnancy?
Sure. Oh. Well, I'll tell you a study from Toronto, Zenzi's and Casper's lab, where the early embryo from a smoking parent had DNA damage from the smoke. And it was specifically an adduct due to a part of the DNA that had been hit by a component in the cigarette smoke.
Huh. So the environment really has an effect.
The major factor was the smoking father.
Wow.
And
that's before the pregnancy. So whatever the father does before the pregnancy is going to impact the pregnancy. Very interesting.
Well, actually, to follow up on that, we have an interesting study with Harvard University. And in that, we looked at the treatment of basically plastics or the exposure to plastics. We find that at a certain period of time, when you are continually exposed, your sperm changes somehow and doesn't revert back to normal. So you have to catch things like that early so that you can actually basically wash it up. A sperm change every 90 days, basically. And if you don't catch it soon enough, then there is a point of almost no return, at least. That's what the data suggests.
Interesting. Fascinating, that aspect. So to the young men, yeah, if you drink and you smoke before you're planning to conceive, you are going to have a big trouble. So stop smoking and drinking, okay?
I think that's a really important part to bring up, because we call that preconception.
A preconception,
so,
yeah.
And so we now recognize that the preconception window, that is before conceiving, is actually really important, and the health of the father, the soon-to-be father, is really important. So drinking, eating, not drinking, but also I would imagine that's the same thing. The preconception health of the woman is also very important.
You went to touch about the preconception in women?
Yeah. I'll kind of follow up with the sperm. There was actually a great study that was presented at ESHRE, which is the European Society of Reproductive Medicine, which showed that high DNA fragmentation, which can be altered by male lifestyle and smoking and drinking, can increase DNA fragmentation. So even if you have a euploid, beautifully created,
yeah,
normal,
but maybe we can, euploid, what do you mean a euploid?
Euploid means chromosomally normal, meaning the right number of chromosomes from the sperm and the right number of
fantastic
chromosomes from the egg.
Thank you.
To equate to chromosomally intact embryo, which should have a 60 to 70% implantation with a 50% live birth rate. However, if there was high fragmentation with a beautifully chromosomally normal embryo, you had a higher miscarriage rate when you had associated lifestyle factors in the male.
Okay. So the preconception before you do all the job to get a baby is, it has as important as the postconception. Okay.
So if you really think about what's happening, the female really takes the bulk of the responsibility because they change their habits quite drastically before they decide to try to get pregnant and have a family. The male has to actually do his part, and this is why it is a couple, to actually start to at least, I guess, for lack of a better word, better say, clean up your act.
So both of them has to step up in that. Fascinating. When should you consider seeking infertility treatment? And is there anything you can do before seeking treatment? I think that before we look a little, but maybe Dr. Janet, you can add a little to that question.
I think that's a great question. So the current guidelines suggest that if you have an underlying diagnosis of a disorder that can cause infertility, like endometriosis, fibroids, PCOS, that you should seek care sooner than later. Sooner being 6 months of unprotected intercourse. Now, if you're 35 and under without an underlying pathology, meaning disease state that could predispose you to infertility, then 1 year of unprotected intercourse. That's super important to remember, because I always tell my patients, they always say, well, we were trying, but not trying. And then we started trying. So I'm here 3 years later, right? So trying, but not trying counts. So it's independent of ovulation predictor kits. It's basically saying no contraception, no withdrawal, no condoms, just having sex for fun. If you did that for 1 year and you're not pregnant and you're under 35, that's when you should seek
care. That's it. Now, you mentioned something that just clicked my brain, because you were mentioning this morning, PCOS. PCOS and infertility. Could you explain a little the meaning of PCOS, and if a patient has diagnosed with PCOS, what she should do?
Yeah. So PCOS means polycystic ovarian syndrome, which is also a misnomer. I often get, well, I don't have cysts, I don't have PCOS. It's not actually cysts. It should be called polyfollicular ovarian disease. So basically, you have a lot of eggs there in your ovaries. So your ovaries are either enlarged or have lots of little tiny eggs, a string of pearls. And if you have that, it presents really differently. Some people are diagnosed very early, but believe it or not, most patients are diagnosed when they're trying to conceive, and it can present really vaguely. So you don't have to look like a typical PCOS, because I know as a patient, I Googled PCOS and I was like, oh, I don't look like that. I must not have it.
Usually it's thought that is, if you're obese, I think there is a question about obesity, high BMI, those increase the risk of PCOS or no?
So you don't necessarily have to have it. PCOS criteria is you need to have two out of the three: multifollicular or enlarged ovaries, irregular cycles greater than 35 days apart. I learned that as a doctor clinically, to say, do do you have regular cycles? And they're like, oh, yeah, like every 60 days, right? So greater than 35 days apart. And then also biochemical or clinical signs of hyperandrogenism. And hyperandrogenism presents very differently based on your ethnicity. So if you ask an Asian if you're hairy, it's very different than if you ask an Indian person who I'm Indian if you're hairy, right? Like our hair patterns are very different. So I always say a male pattern. So hair thinning, hair on your knuckles, on your chin, a testosterone-driven hair pattern. So it's super important to remember.
Fantastic.
And it's vague that a PCOS may look very different than you, but you may have
so a patient with all those symptoms should go really and have a consultation and a careful examination.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we have a question from Kelly. If a woman leads a healthy lifestyle, has normal BMI, it develops gestational diabetes. Is it a female problem or is it something that the male can contribute to? Okay, before we ask the woman, what do you think? The male and gestational diabetes, that's a fascinating question. I mean, some animal experiments suggest that if the male is exposed to environmental factors, at least in mouse, you have some data that maybe there is a kind of abnormal growth or
some mouse studies we've shown that some environmental exposures could increase the cholesterol in the males.
The cholesterol is
cholesterol.
Yeah, is the substrate that it uses the body in order to produce energy, hormones, and so on.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we've shown that mating those males with unexposed females, the offspring have high cholesterol as well.
Okay.
What is happening in the father, the phenotype, or what the disease is in the father could be transmitted.
It's not so crazy to think even that the father may contribute to gestational diabetes. What do you think, doctor?
I agree. I think it's embryo as a whole. It takes two to make an embryo, both the mom.
But the mother is the one who suffered gestational diabetes.
Unfortunately, yes.
Unfortunately.
But I think it stems back to inflammation, that there's some sort of inflammatory component, whether it's from the embryo or the epithelium, that's causing inflammatory disorders like gestational diabetes, preeclampsia, or pregnancy-related complications.
Fascinating. What is the next question, George?
This one by Carolina.
What should a couple who are thinking about having a child in the future do to increase their chances of having a healthy child? And when should these measures be taken? 1 month? Rather than a year before the first attempt of conception, is there a simple recipe to increase the chance? Open to the question for everybody. What do you think?
Well, certainly, we know age is important for your chances of having a successful pregnancy. And so how you think about the window of time you need before trying to get pregnant depends on the age you are when you're thinking of starting a family. So if you're over 30, you probably should start thinking about it a lot earlier. If in your early 20s, maybe you don't need to think about it quite as early, but it's still important. Of course, the lifestyle things are always important, and they aren't just in the short window right before.
Yeah.
In fact, the preconception window could extend all the way to the time when a man or a woman was a little fetus in their mom's belly, and they were exposed to all the things that mom was exposed to, and that could impact their ability to produce eggs or sperm in the future and their chances of having a pregnancy.
So now I think you open it. A box of questions when you talk about the age. So we know now that women are delaying the time of their pregnancies. And some of them, they reach the age of 34, 35 because they were in medical school, the residency, the fellowship. And they say, wow, I want to preserve my ovaries before I start medical school. Yeah. What do we know about that? So what would you suggest? I mean, you have a program running in Pittsburgh about organ.
So one thing that's becoming more and more popular, if a woman knows ahead of time, I'm not going to have my family until later in life, for all the reasons you said, I'm finishing my education, I'm starting my career, et cetera. But she should know, and if she doesn't, we can say it here, her chances of getting pregnant are worse the older that she gets.
Yeah.
And so what is becoming more and more popular is to do a thing that's called social egg freezing. That is
social egg freezing.
Yes.
Okay. That means you put together several women for prison, for social, or what do you mean?
Certainly the women could get together in the social if they want to. But what it means is that a woman might consider freezing her eggs when she's still young,
okay,
say 28 years old, so that when she's ready to get pregnant, she can use those young eggs rather than the older ones that are in her ovaries. Of course, she has to use in vitro fertilization with those eggs, but she can use those young eggs to establish that you have a greater chance of having a healthy pregnancy.
And is there a dangerous that to do the process of collecting those eggs?
I will punt on this one, except to say that, of course, there are risks for doing the hormonal stimulation that causes the eggs to mature and to collect the eggs, and now I'll punt.
I have a very biased opinion. You have the key to my heart officially. The age dictates fertility, and I agree that, you know, I know you said 28, so I often get patients asking, like, once you do freeze your eggs, I'm going to wait till I'm 35. And really, I want to say, no, that's too late. Like, if you want to freeze your eggs, you need to freeze them in your 20s, because the probability and the likelihood of it turning into a baby or building your family is the highest. Now, what are the risks that come with it? It's a minor surgical procedure, so the risk of bleeding, infection, but it's 10 minutes, anesthesia. The risk of hormones, I always get asked, like, is there a risk of cancer? Is there, that's something, am I going to lose my ex forever? Am I going in menopause? So we're only using where your body's activated.
Okay.
So you use it or you lose it. And no increased risk of menopause and no increased risk of breast or ovarian cancer.
Fantastic. And I think this has been going for a while. I mean, there are multiple centers that have been already cryopreserving oocytes and even ovaries. We have here, unfortunately, the majority of males. So what about the male?
Oh, sorry. I was just going to ask a question. So in a group practice, you decide amongst your partners what sort of policies you want to have. But there's also, you're a member of an organization, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, which has a practice committee. So they tell you sort of these sorts of questions. So the safety risk for many years now has been hyperstimulation. And as that's more controllable by changing the hormonal milieu and practice, the practice committee now said the hyperstimulation risk is so low that women entering college preparing to go through this entire series could do it. So tell, I don't remember what the year was. It was not that long ago, 2018, when the committee delivered that the safety issue was so calmed down that even young women could go and not be at risk.
2012.
Yeah. It was longer ago than that.
It has been a while. It has been a while, and it's a lot of experience. So let's go back to our listeners for another question. How does environmental exposures impact fertility? Does it impact females more because they are born with all of their eggs and accumulate toxins throughout life? Or does the male semen have equal impact? How we can prevent this impact? Please.
So yeah, I'm the PI of a $50 million grant from NIH called ECHO, which stands for Environmental Contributions to Child Health Outcomes. And it has about 50,000 pregnant women nationwide who are recruited, about 2,000 in Michigan. So I'm in charge of the Michigan group. And we recruit mothers in the first trimester. So it doesn't really address fertility, but it affects how the environment affects children's health outcomes.
Yeah.
It's a longitudinal study, and we follow the kids and their teens.
Yeah.
But Rick Pilsner is on this grant too, and he's studying how the environment affects the second child's birth. So we recruit the mother for her first child at the first trimester. And then about 18 months later, which is about 15 to 18 months later, which is about the time they get pregnant that they're having a second child, we're analyzing exposures and biospecimen and sperm and male fertility. So that's something that we hope to address.
Do you think that is the woman is more susceptible to environmental factors?
That's
you
the
think
dogma,
about...
but that's why we brought in Rick, because, you know, he seems to...
What is your opinion, Rick? Is the male as susceptible as the woman to environmental factors?
I think it's equivalent. I think largely we're now interested in the male because the males have been ignored for so long. It's been a hyper-focus on the females and their environmental health and their lifestyle choices.
Yeah.
And as Dr. Kawitz has indicated, it takes two to tango, right?
Absolutely.
It's
yeah.
a couple things.
But,
and the male has been largely ignored for decades.
We're changing the paradigm in that.
Right.
So bringing that, I think you mentioned about the age of the woman as a factor for fertility. What are the males? So we can reproduce until we're 100 years old. Who is there? Is a famous actor now that has a new child?
Yeah.
What's called his name?
De Niro.
De Niro. De Niro. 82 years old.
Yeah.
So do I have hope that 80 years old I can still start having a family?
Trump had Barron when he was
sick. So we're not politics. Not politics. We don't touch politics. This, remember, this is recorded and it will be online. But
definitely, a male can have a child when he's in the 80s. You just stated the evidence of it. There are risks, though. So men can continue to produce sperm. The quality of the sperm could decrease. The number of sperm could decrease. But there's also a thing called the paternal age effect, and that is that older fathers have a higher risk of having kids with particular diseases.
Mm.
There's a lot of heavy science behind that.
Yeah.
But the simple statement is what it is. Older fathers have a higher risk of having patients with birth defects.
Okay, so there's something to consider.
Yeah, we actually are recommending sperm freeze. We have a lot of older patients. So after age 45, if you're looking to conceive with a younger partner, recommend freezing sperm.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned something about it was fascinating. You can even freeze and keep the testicles?
We can.
You can?
Yeah. But let me answer the question that you didn't have, because this is the question that I get all the time. And but related to your question, we freeze ovaries and testicles or tissues for kids who won't come back to use those tissues for many, many years.
Ah.
These are kids that are at risk of infertility because of a medical treatment that they're getting for cancer or other circumstances. Well, because you're doing it for kids, the obvious question is, how long can you leave those samples frozen and they still be functional to produce a healthy baby?
Correct.
Well, with freezing tissues, we can't answer that question because we've only been doing it for a couple of decades. But we can point to the world experience of freezing sperm or freezing embryos.
Mm-hmm.
Can't even comment
but
on
it. Freezing embryos already is done regularly.
So,
but something that was fascinating for me is the testicles.
The testicles, yeah. So, but what I can say is that we can freeze sperm for 40 years. It's still possible to thaw and have a healthy baby.
Wow.
We can freeze embryos for, I think the oldest I heard is either 30 or 35 years, thaw them out and have a healthy baby. And so if tissues are like sperm and eggs, then maybe that will be possible, but simply we haven't been doing it long.
And who will be applying this for this freezing tissues?
Yes, so these are patients who are not able. So, of course, if you want to preserve your future fertility, you should freeze eggs or freeze sperm if you can do it.
Okay.
Because
We
know we can use eggs and sperm to have a baby. We've been doing it for more than 40 years now. There's over 6 million babies produced using in vitro fertilization technologies. So these freezing tissue technologies are for patients who cannot freeze eggs, cannot freeze sperm.
Yeah.
And I mentioned one type of those patients, and that's young patients who haven't gone through puberty yet, so they don't have any eggs or sperm to freeze.
Yeah.
But they do have some.
Those are you mentioning kids who maybe have cancer or any other conditions?
Yes, a kid who's getting a chemotherapy or radiation treatment for cancer may be at risk of becoming infertile as a result of that treatment, even before they're thinking about having a family.
Of course,
so they're 5 years
think
old.
At that age. Yeah.
Even though those patients aren't producing eggs or sperm, they do have precursor cells in their ovaries or testes that we believe will have the potential to produce eggs or sperm.
When you talk about precursor cells, those are like the mother cells. We will give origin to the oocyte or to the sperm.
The sperm, that's correct.
Fascinating. Okay, so we go... In Michigan, the marijuana is approved.
Actually, an interesting study in our ECHO Michigan study, actually nationwide, is 60% of women use marijuana during pregnancy.
Is that
in
right?
Our ECHO cohort, yeah.
Wow. And that's a question from Spencer. How does vaping and smoking marijuana impact male and female fertility? What effect does it have on the eggs and sperm? Additionally, how can consuming edibles impact this? Okay, that's a fascinating question because we see every corner I see those selling marijuana. Gentlemen.
Well, certainly we know that marijuana use decreases sperm quality.
It does.
It does.
Okay, so listen carefully to this. Marijuana, but continuous consume, or if I have one marijuana, I fry it, then
I think a regular use.
Regular use.
But again, I'm not the expert in that, but I would think if you are wanting to conceive, you should abstain from using marijuana and potentially alcohol and other things as well. And I don't think smoking it versus eating it is going to really make much of a difference.
Really?
I think it would have a very similar effect.
Anybody else wants to add to that?
Make a science comment from the mouse model.
Yeah.
So I think most people will know in our audience that if there's morphine, the reason that a plant component is active in us is because we have endomorphins in our body. And it looks like our own mammalian endomorphin. Endocannabinoids are something that we have in mice, in the mouse model. And the cannabinoids obviously are something that you can get by smoking or other means of ingestion. The endocannabinoids in mouse are important for implantation.
Oh.
And spacing implantation. So it has a role, and not in the question that I think the difference been addressed so far is the before conception, but
that's
after
correct.
Conception, it may affect entering
also the implantation.
Implanting and entering the uterus in the mouse model.
Thank you. That's a very interesting aspect. Let's see another question.
I just had a follow-up. I wanted to ask Dr. Gelini, do you give any advice to men prior to infertility treatment in terms of drug use, alcohol use, marijuana use?
I do. I think lifestyle plays a big role when it comes to fertility, both male and female. There was a study that showed that after smoking even once, and you tested the hair follicles, that the marijuana can actually be present up to 3 months.
Wow.
The same as a sperm cycle. So it stays in your system, even if you do it once. And I don't think there's a difference. Actually, there's no difference whether you smoke it or you eat it. It affects receptivity, and it can increase fragmentation, full of the egg and sperm, leading to poor blastocyte, meaning embryo development and culture.
Fascinating. That's a very important information. I hope people will listen also to this podcast or this YouTube. Just let me remind everybody that this conversation will be posted in our website, and it will be available in your podcast, whatever you use, either your Apple or any other type of telephone, as well as in YouTube. So let's go to the next question. That's an interesting question from Megan. There is a stigma against women exercising while pregnant. Do you know if women exercising, running and strength training through the pregnancy, they give birth and fat and have fast deliveries and very healthy babies? What is everyone's thoughts on exercise during pregnancy?
Really?
I think you should exercise during pregnancy. It improves pregnancy outcomes, like you said. So moderate level of exercise, 2 to 3 times a week, has been shown to increase shorten the duration from onset of labor to delivery, also decreases the risk of pregnancy-related complications. And the stigma against exercise in pregnancy, I think it's more an old wives' tale, not necessarily a science fact. But there is a stigma with IVF pregnancies and exercising, and the premise behind that is completely different. So what I tell my patients is at implantation, when I'm doing a transfer, I don't want you to go run, right? I don't want to move the blood flow away from your uterus. So a simple rule to follow is keep your heart rate below 150. Do not move your blood flow from your non-necessary organs like your uterus to the organs that are going to recover. Your legs are your biggest muscle. So if you're going to go on this run, where do you think that blood flow is going to shift? So it is a very scientific application to a process that may not need it. So especially if you're not used to working out like that, don't start after a number of transits.
That's correct. But I think exactly adding to what you say that is perfect is, as when women is pregnant, they need the increase of the needs of oxygen metabolism and so on are very high from the non-pregnant. So having a normal exercise allows the woman to supplement that need of oxygen and some factors. So yeah. Definitely, don't do extreme exercise. Don't go and compete in extreme.
That's what is asked that. So I mean, it's known that if you need pulsatile, pituitary hormones, and you're exercising too much, you lose those, and you can go out of normal periodicity. So
that's a non-pregnant.
So
that's
so,
a non-pregnant.
But you can also lose pregnancies as well. You diverting energy to marathon running.
That is extreme sports.
That's why. So I was going to ask you, because I'm giving anecdotes. Do you advise them on what too much exercise?
So if your body's conditioned to running a marathon and you're pregnant, you can run that marathon, right? Because you're already conditioned.
Correct.
Remember, after the second trimester, you no longer require that pituitary function to maintain that pregnancy, because it's like a hypothalamic patient, meaning when they have no non-pituitary function, once that placenta kicks in, you don't need to support that pregnancy with hormonal support. So that theory won't apply to a pregnant state, but super important to remember that your body's adapting to a whole new organ, right? It's like,
and how about first trimester or new increased regimen when you're not used to it at any point?
Yeah, so if it's something new, I always say wait till the first trimester till your body accepts this wrapped tissue or an embryo or a baby,
right,
and then you can resume.
Fantastic. So in summary, what you're saying is do the exercise before and then continuously. Don't start just at the beginning of the pregnancy.
These two are related questions.
Okay, how much does it cost to freeze eggs? And how can medical PhD students afford to be proactive about the cost?
That is a great question. It costs a lot, but not a lot in the grand scheme of things. A typical egg freezing cycle is anywhere from $5,000 to $8,000.
Insurance will cover that?
So not in Michigan. In Illinois, it will.
We're moving to Illinois, yes?
Yes.
Where am I in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania?
Pennsylvania does not have mandated insurance coverage for fertility treatment.
Really? So it's only Illinois?
It's nine states out of...
So it's the minority.
Yeah.
It's the minority.
So
incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Then it's ultra cold storage. How much does that cost per year?
So that's not that bad. There's long-term storage facilities like ReproTech in Minnesota. That's about 250. So the actual act of the egg retrieval is what's the most expensive part. But like you mentioned, there's actually a lot of social egg freezing. There's clubs and there's discounts. And there's, during COVID, there was a lot of travel programs that came about to group egg freezing.
And communities also
help.
It's true.
Yeah.
How about you miss the payment?
They don't destroy tissue. There's a lot of legal liability. So you may, knock on wood, there's never been a clinic that's destroyed tissue.
Yeah, that's true. So there is another question because it's incredible. You see, the time goes very fast. Obviously, sperm is only one component of semen. Is the plasma important at all? What studies have been done so far?
So the plasma is important for a few different reasons. At first, once the sperm are deposited in the female reproductive tract, they all coagulate. But a sperm that's all stuck together in a clump obviously is not going to fertilize an egg. And so there's components in the plasma that release the sperm from that knot, and so they can swim through the female reproductive tract and fertilize the egg. That's true for natural conception. For in vitro fertilization, usually the sperm are washed, and so then the plasma is...
It doesn't need the clothing and all the things that they protect.
That's exactly right.
Okay. So I hope we miss. What is the next one, George?
Sperm grinding.
Do you think that the collection of stem cells from the umbilical cord after birth could be a hope in the future for people who have lost their ability to reproduce, example, chemotherapy? We're talking now stem cells.
So the answer is no.
That's interesting.
The stem cells that are in the umbilical cord are stem cells that know how to make blood and immune cells. They don't know how to make other cell types in the body. There was a myth many years ago. Why do we need stem cells that come from embryos or other places? We can use umbilical cord.
Correct.
Stem cells to treat everything.
Correct.
It's not true. These are blood stem cells, and they make blood components.
Let me stop you here. Some people say that you can take a piece of skin
okay.
and make a sperm. Why not from the cord blood?
In principle, you could do that, but that's not using the cord blood stem cells directly. It would be reprogramming cord blood stem cells to what they looked like when they were in a little embryo.
So that is a magic word, that reprogramming. Could you tell us a little more what is reprogramming?
Yeah. So in the early embryo, that means an embryo that's one cells or two cells or even four cells big, every one of those cells has the potential to produce every different tissue of the body. But that potential disappears after a while. Once the embryo is up to 14 days, it's begun to produce your gut and your lungs and your future sperm and eggs. And so what reprogramming means is that we're reprogramming any cell in the body, a skin cell, a blood cell, any cell, back to the state that it was an early embryo, like a one cell embryo.
It can do everything again.
And then it can do everything.
Can we do that?
So in that context, and in theory, an umbilical cord stem cell could do that. Every cell in your body could do that. But some of them do it better than others. And skin fibroblasts, a skin biopsy, is one of the ones that is very easy to reprogram. Turns out blood cells are quite a bit more difficult to reprogram.
We know that, Fascinating.
Want
it, Surya? Surya has a question. How's the basic science in the areas of sperm and oocyte developing and the cell biology reproductive system? The meiosis. Oh my goodness, help on both understanding. So let's talk, I think, in little about the oocyte, that big cell in our body, which is going to give origin to what we are now. So it means from one cell, it has to become 10 to the 12 cells. How important is that process? It goes to you.
I mean, I think the clinicians know more, but
from your point of view, how is understanding that?
I mean, there's a whole aspect of understanding the oocyte quality.
Okay.
And I think typically, so if you have a human oocyte, you can't label all of its cellular features or without killing it. So morphology and general features are what guide the understanding of oocyte quality. And then you have the early divisions, and Dan probably can help on this. The rate of cleavage,
the shape
of the membrane and ruffles or not ruffles. You know,
so let me ask you a question.
There are morphological features, but underneath all of that is an engine.
Yeah.
And how well that engine is running will impact all of those features.
So the research that many of the people here in the Mod Center and many places trying to understand how a cell divides, do you think will have an impact in future fertility or infertility or understanding infertility?
I do, yes. Dan talked about the black hole of unsuccessful pregnancies for reasons we don't know.
Yeah.
A huge percentage of those could be embryos that have been failing some aspect of cell division.
Yeah.
They looked at mitochondria, the mitospore, the energy that embryo has to expend to implant.
Yeah.
But there was no clinical correlation. But I, in my clinical practice, looked at how does the mitospore relate to implantation. Is if the score is higher, meaning it expended a lot of energy to become an embryo, does it have a lower chance of success?
Yeah.
Or does it tend to miscarry? I personally couldn't find a clinical correlation.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's interesting to see how much energy it's spent.
Mitospore, can you tell us a little bit more about what that is for the audience? Is that a charge of the mitochondria, its function, or the number, or a combination?
It's a combination of both. So it gives a mitospore is a report of basically how, when I break it down to my patients, I say the amount of energy expended. Think of the mitochondria as the powerhouse of your embryo. And if the mitospore is high, meaning it spent a lot of energy for embryo development, then technically what they hypothesized was the implantation should be lower and the miscarriage rate should be higher. So initially, a couple of years ago when it came out, we were using it on the PGT report to say, okay.
The PGT is checking the quality of the cells in the embryo.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. So if we're saying if this is a PGT normal, meaning chromosomally normal embryo, let's use that as our first prognostic factor. Then let's look at what day it became an embryo, day 5, day 6, or day 7, as our second prognostic factor. And then let's throw in the mitospore, that if the mitospore is really high,
the energy production,
then let's use this embryo last, because we want the lowest energy production I always say it's like easy breezy to cross the finish line, but I couldn't find a clinical
person. Yeah, is that an easy thing for embryologists?
Sorry to interrupt you. Let's move a little forward because we have a lot of questions. Are the biomarkers that can indicate increased miscarriage risk? If so, are there any preventive therapeutic use? Have you been successful? We have any biomarkers for miscarriages?
We have a simple one, and that is to count chromosomes and see whether the embryo has a normal number of chromosomes.
Yeah.
And that's done pretty routinely in the fertility clinic. And so that's a simple diagnosis and a simple solution. If you have five embryos and two or three of them have a normal number of chromosomes, then those are the ones you would choose to transfer first.
Yeah.
Important, having a bad number of chromosomes with this test does not necessarily mean that the embryo doesn't work.
Really?
Because you sample just a piece of the embryo. That piece may represent the embryo that's going to produce the baby, but it may not perfectly represent it. So there, you would choose the embryo that had a normal number of chromosomes, but you have a woman and she doesn't have any with the normal number of chromosomes, I assume you still would transfer, and in many cases, these lead to healthy babies. Is that correct?
That is true, but there's a shift. Before, we used to think of it as very black and white, that if this is chromosomally normal, then you use it. If it's abnormal, then you don't use it. How we're starting to look at PGT is now a shift. So it's the most normal cells, the least normal cells, but not all clinics have been as progressive to transfer abnormals or mosaics and segmentals. And basically what that means is some of the cells are normal, some of them are abnormal. Do we take the risk of transferring that?
So let me touch about the PGT because, and again, many people are afraid, wow, you're going to take one cell from that embryo. Are you going to damage the development? What is the risk of PGT?
So there's a very low risk of PGT. It's trophoblastic, meaning the outer layer.
So that is an important clarifying. So you're not going and taking from the baby. You're taking from that external layer. Yeah.
Which becomes the placenta. And there's a big argument that when you're biopsying it, if it comes back abnormal, is it something called confined placental mosaicism?
Correct.
Which Dr. Rapoli in his talk earlier talked about how quickly these trophoblastic cells divide, and they're the lead cause of the HCG that we see. So if we're biopsying 3 to 5 cells, they have the ability to regenerate very quickly.
So I have time. Yeah. So in mouse model, some people at University of Michigan Caltech got together and they found that if they made all the cells in 1 8-cell embryo anyway with a chemical, and then they added it to a normal embryo, all 8 cells, so they dissociated, add all the 8 plus 8 together, their size is normal after they're implanted. And the other thing they found is that where it was intolerable to have aneuploid cell was the cells that are future us, which are not the ones you're measuring with PGT. So it's quite likely that you're mismanaging if you're doing a PGT on trophectoderm, on the outer cell, I should say.
Yeah.
Because they will accumulate more error.
Interesting. So there is a little area here to continue.
Yes. I would just like to add one point. At the Mott Center, we're part of a multi-center consortium for looking at recurrent pregnancy loss. We are going to do a genetic basis, and that is we will sequence each individual or each couple that meets the criteria for the study. This is one way to develop a series of biomarkers, something we do not know. It's a nationwide study also, and the lead group, at least on the East Coast, is Yale University.
Thank you. That is exciting. We hope on that. So you say it's about sequencing. Dr. Pine, where are we now in reading our genetic information?
Well, sequencing is a technology that can measure the feature of the nucleotides of, that is the letters of the genomes, right? You have A, C, G, T, that is the letters are in the genomes, and we measure those. But in the past, well, the cause and the throughput, it's kind of a problem, but now the cause is not a problem anymore, at least in the basic science research, and the cause is keep going down and the quality is going up. So there's a higher potential than the past decade that we can utilize the sequencing technology to measure the samples and from the parents or the babies or the embryo. Well, we talk about omics, and sequencing technology is a way that we can measure those all makes feature that the feature of the molecules in our genome. Yeah.
So do you think the new technology will help us to read that normal information that exists and potentially overcome the problem of the low success in having babies?
Well, I cannot say 100% for sure, because the technology is evolving very quickly, and we find a lot of things that we don't know in the past. That case, from like the epigenetic as transcriptomics, that
some very heavy words you're using.
The omics. We spend something that we completely have no idea in the last centuries or last decade, but we keep finding new insight in biology. So I think this also improves the powers of our technology to understand the basic science in a better way, but also that we know that we cannot do it perfectly at this moment. They're very likely doing better and better.
But will sequencing help personalize medicine?
Yeah, exactly. So like in the 1990s, well, we spent about $3 billion in sequencing.
How many?
$3 billion.
$3 billion sequencing.
And now
that's one person.
Yeah.
But now you just spend a few hundred dollars to sequence a single person. It's possible. So now I think it's become more affordable for a single patient to generate a genome of the patient's own to study some very specific features of the patient.
Do you see that in the future, the future father and mother can do a sequencing before the conception?
Exactly, why not? So I think that is something we're comparing to the cause, like the surgery, like IVF, well, that is something that a reasonable cause that you can measure prior to the test.
Are we compatible?
Yeah, exactly.
They're doing actually whole genomic sequencing of the embryo. There's a company that just launched that's doing whole genomic sequencing, picking up disease states that we were never able to pick up with PGT before.
Yeah. Fantastic. You know, I don't want to go before we have one more point that you brought about the age. And I was fascinated with Dr. Pilsner has been doing. So I can be 60-something years old, but maybe my sperm is very young. Or I can be 30 years old, I'm a sperm old. In 1 minute, can you tell us about that?
Sure. We think about age as chronological age, and every trip around the sun, you age 1 year. But what that doesn't really capture is the rate of aging of your cells. And so we call this biological aging. And so someone may be 40 years old chronologically, just celebrated their 40th birthday, but their eggs or their sperm may be older or younger based on their lifestyle, as well as probably some genetics as well. So
that is the genetics, sequencing.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. Thank you so much. So with this, I think we are going to wrap it up. I want to thank all the members of the panel for your contributions and answering all the questions, and also to the public for the fantastic questions that you brought to the table. Again, I want to remind that this will be this is recorded, and it will be posted in the website of the Mott Center and available on YouTube as well as a podcast. With that, we say good night, and thank you, everybody.
Cheers.
Cheers.